Well, last week we reminded ourselves of that famous quotation from General Booth that when you start something for God, first of all it seems impossible, and then it's difficult, and then it's done. And we said that Nehemiah's life was really an illustration of that, because of course rebuilding the wall was first of all an impossible task, and it required of him to be a man of prayer. Then, when against all the human odds, his prayer was answered and the opportunity was given him to rebuild the wall, it became simply a difficult task, facing huge opposition of all different kinds, which we were thinking about last week, and that required him to be a man of courage. Well, now we're going to talk about that period of Nehemiah's life when the job, at least the job he initially set out to do, of rebuilding the wall, was finished, when it was done. But this also required of him a very specific kind of character as the leader of God's people. It required him to be a man of principle. Now, to be quite honest, the chronology of the book of Nehemiah, once you get after the first few weeks while they were rebuilding the wall, becomes rather complicated. Chapter 6, verse 15 tells us they rebuilt the wall in 52 days, which seems a remarkably short period of time, and that may just be the superstructure of the wall. It may not involve all the polishing up operations and the ornamentation and so on, which probably went onto the wall as well. What we do know is, from chapter 5, verse 14, the text we read, that Nehemiah stayed in Jerusalem much longer than just that. He was appointed governor in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, we're told, in verse 14 of chapter 5, and he remained in that office until the 32nd year, that's 12 years in all. Nor was that the end of his career, because if you turn right to the last chapter, chapter 13, verse 6, you'll find he tells us there that though he returned to Babylonia at the end of that 12-year term for a period, he later came back to Jerusalem once again for a second term in office as governor. So always round, it's rather difficult to be sure exactly when, during Nehemiah's long period of jurisdiction in Jerusalem, some of these events that he tells us about in his memoirs took place. What is clear, though, is that once the wall was completed, and to some extent perhaps even before it was completed, a number of very critical moral and social issues began to arise within the Jewish community, which required of him extraordinary integrity and moral zeal. And the first one we came across in our reading, in chapter 5, which probably happened in the very early days of his ministry, an issue of social justice. The men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers, we read in chapter 5. We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain. We're mortgaging our fields and our vineyards to get grain during the famine. We've had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Poverty is a problem we see a lot in our television screens these days. But of course it's not a new problem. It was a problem for Nehemiah. It was aggravated in Jerusalem, we're told here, by four things. First of all, large families. We and our sons and daughters are numerous, they say. Secondly, shortage of food. Verse 3 mentions a famine. Thirdly, the inland revenue. Verse 4 talks about the king's tax. That would have been, of course, the Persian tax levied by the emperor. None of those three things Nehemiah could do very much about. But the fourth factor, which was aggravating the poverty of the people, he could do something about. Exploitation. That's what it was. The wealthy were making a killing out of the economic deprivation and vulnerability of the poor. And you see, the key root evil, verse 7, you are exacting usury, that is, interest, from your own countrymen. It's not difficult to see what was going on. The people were hungry. They owed their taxes. They had no crops to sell of their own. So they were having to borrow money. And they borrowed it from their own fellow Jews. But those fellow Jews charged them interest. And when they couldn't afford the repayments, they were forced to mortgage their fields and their vineyards. The land which, in a more productive year, would be the means of sustenance for them, they had to mortgage and perhaps even eventually lose in order to try and repay their loans. When that resource was exhausted and they still owed more money, they were even forced to selling their own children into slavery in order to meet their debts. It's no wonder we read the men and their wives were raising a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. And it wasn't foreigners who were exploiting the Jews. It was the nobility, it was the rich and the wealthy in their community who were taking advantage of this situation to twist the economic screw and to make yet more money for themselves. You can see what Nehemiah felt about it. Verse 6, when I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. The reason for Nehemiah's anger is quite simple. Such a thing was not only contrary to all compassion and fellow feeling, it was quite clearly illegal. It was against the law of Moses. According to the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus, it was quite illegal to charge interest, to charge usury, on loans to a fellow Israelite. And that principle is stated over and over again. Of course, the precise interpretation of that law has caused a little headache to the Christian church over the years. Ever since Calvin, the tradition of Protestant scholarship is that this provision only applied to what we would call charitable loans, not to the kind of commercial borrowing which we would call today investment. Whether that's true or not, I have my severe doubts. But it is certainly true that where interest is charged on loans, in an agrarian situation of poverty, greater poverty results. In fact, I think you could argue that wherever interest is charged, even in a developed economy, polarization of wealth takes place. Because what the interest rate does, what the money market does, if you want to use the modern term, is to put distributive justice at a premium. It means that economic power becomes concentrated in the hands of those who have money to lend and puts those who have to borrow money at a great disadvantage. It means that those who have money to lend or who can pay or willing to pay for the privilege can accumulate money to themselves in order to monopolize the economy. And I think you could make a strong case for saying that that's precisely what's happened wherever the interest rate has prevailed, and it's certainly prevailed in Europe ever since the Reformation, when for the first time interest on loans was permitted. Certainly Nehemiah, his reaction to this charging of interest on loans is extraordinarily indignant. He clearly regards it as a great sin. Just notice the way he reacts to it. First of all, his reaction is one of anger. Verse 6, I was very angry, he says. When we come across a situation of social injustice, that's precisely how we should feel. Some Christians have a conscience about feeling angry. They seem to think Christians should always be meek and mild and never get irate about anything. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Bible says that God is often angry about the right thing. And it is perfectly proper for us to reflect that anger. When we see social injustice, anger is the only moral response. But of course that anger has to be channeled properly. Notice what we read in verse 7. I pondered these charges in my mind. So Nehemiah didn't allow his hot temper to carry him away and do something reckless and irresponsible. He was thoughtful. He planned. Here was a social evil. He had to do something about it. And he was going to channel that anger, that moral fury inside him, in a way which was constructive rather than destructive to the community. The way he hit upon, actually, as you'll see in verses 7 and 8, is the mobilization of public opinion. I called together a large meeting, he said. These days we would say he got the press involved. He held a press conference. He got a lot of people around and presented the outrage as a scandal going on, he said. And in the context of that large meeting, you see, he appeals to the exploiters. Notice the grounds of his appeal. First of all, He appeals to their consciences. Verse 9. What you are doing is not right, he says. It's important to realize that wicked capitalists who exploit their fellow countrymen have consciences, and they can be appealed to, especially if public opinion happens to be involved. That AIDS appeals to conscience extraordinarily, but the conscience is there. And Nehemiah isn't afraid to rebuke them, to tell them, it's not right what you're doing. Surely you realize that. Secondly, you notice he appeals to national pride. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? Now, as we were saying last week, it may not be regarded as the best of all motives to do things simply out of chauvinistic interest in your own nation and its reputation. But when you're dealing with imperfect men and women, that motive isn't to be sniffed at, isn't to be ignored, isn't to be despised. Nehemiah certainly didn't despise it. Surely, he says, you should be doing things in God's way rather than risking the reproach of the foreigners around us. I mean, what are they going to say when they see Jew exploiting Jew? What are they going to think of our nation? He says. Well, once again, national pride is something that can often be appealed to in this kind of issue. But supremely, what Nehemiah appeals to, you will see in the latter half of this chapter 5, is his own personal example. Look at verse 10. I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain, but let the exacting of usury stop. In other words, look, I'm having to lend folk food because of the famine. I've got to pay out of my resources for the poor, but I'm not charging interest. In fact, if you look at the latter half of the chapter in verses 16 and 17 and 18, he stresses over and over again how that during that whole 12-year period in which he was governor, he never used his position to exploit the common people. He talks about, for instance, his refusal in verse 15 to charge a tax. Though as governor, he could legally have charged a tax to meet his expenses, but he refused to do so. Governors before him had done so, but he refused to place that heavy burden on the people. He says in verse 16, that throughout the period he devoted himself to labor, even physical labor, on the wall while that was still being built, and all his men. He didn't go in for the land-grabbing business, which was so common amongst other nobility. What's more, he says, though he had very expensive commitments as governor, having to lay on a lavish table for the nobility and all the visiting diplomats whom he had to entertain, and though it cost him an awful lot of money out of his personal purse to provide all those things, and though he could legitimately have demanded the food allotted to the governor to make provision for those diplomatic expenses, he never did so. He never did so, he says, because he realized the demands were heavy on the people, verse 18. He had a heart for the common people. He was aware of the economic constraints on them, and he did not wish to add to their burden. So out of the generosity of his own resources, he met those expenses. Now, I know it sounds a bit as if dear old Nehemiah is blowing his own trumpet rather a lot here. And perhaps, in a sense, he had to. Because the other nobility, the people who were, as it were, alongside him, just one level down in the Persian hierarchy in the government, they were the people who were doing the exploiting, and they had to see from the top. But he didn't only say, he did. He was no hypocrite in this matter. Personal example's terribly important. But I think it's important to remember, too, that very likely what Nehemiah writes here in his memoirs was not originally intended for public distribution. It may well have been a personal diary, which the chronicler has got hold of and incorporated, lot, stock and barrel, in his own writings. And if that were so, then this is a personal memorandum, a kind of a personal diary between Nehemiah and God. In that sense, he's not blowing his trumpet at all. And I think that note comes out, doesn't it, in verse 19, where we see the true motive that was underlying this altruism in the man. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I've done for these people. Again and again, little prayers like that come out which show that Nehemiah isn't really thinking about the big world out there and telling them all the good things he's done. He's thinking of the great God up there and wants a clear conscience with him. This was a governor who knew himself accountable to a higher sovereign, and it showed. Showed in the moral zeal he brought to bear on social problems. An enormous lesson for us here. You don't need me to tell you that this Christmas is going to be a very bitter time for lots of people in our community, let alone when we look to the global village we're part of now, in the world at large. It's going to be a very sad time for people on the dole, for people on strike, whatever you think of that particular strike. There are going to be many, many people facing austerities. In fact, the 1980s look as if this is going to be a perennial problem for us. We're going to have to cope with a considerable amount of poverty in our society, relative poverty at any rate. How do we feel about it? How do we feel if we see people making the matter worse? Can we identify people actually exploiting the situation in any way? What do we feel about interest rates, for instance? Maybe we ought to think very hard about social justice in our world at large, and particularly in our own community, and ask whether our reaction is the same as Nehemiah's, whether we are angry about it or merely apathetic, whether we think through a strategy, a campaign for doing something about it, or whether we merely shrug our shoulders and say, who knows? Whether we're interested in being involved in public opinion, whether we believe there's a role for us as Christians in stirring up public opinion over matters of social conscience, whether we feel there are things to appeal to, particularly whether it's possible to appeal to our own example, or do we just emulate the pattern of things around us? Could we claim to be as generous, as unselfish, as Nehemiah in the use of our resources, in the use we make of our position, whatever that might be? Nehemiah, a man of principle. If we're going to be leaders, then we need to be men of principle. The second area which Nehemiah had to tackle during his period as governor was what I would call spiritual neglect. And this comes at the other end of the book, in chapter 13. Now, there are a number of matters involved here, not just one, the matter of the interest that people were charging on loans. Here we can see a number of symptoms of the spiritual neglect that was characteristic of the people, at least later on, after the wall was finished, perhaps towards the end or in the second term of Nehemiah's reign as governor. The first, you'll notice, was neglect of God's house in verses 4 to 9. We find in chapter 13, verse 4, that Eliashib, the priest, who was in charge of the storerooms of the house of God, was closely associated with Tobiah. Now, you remember Tobiah, don't you, from last week? He was Sanballat's mate, and one of the people, one of the foreigners, who were constantly threatening the wall and seeking by exploiting his friends among the nobility to undermine Nehemiah's authority in the city. He was closely associated with Eliashib, the priest. And you see what Eliashib had done. He'd provided him with a large room, formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine, and oil prescribed for the Levite singers and gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. In other words, his chap Tobiah had been given an office in the temple. And all the stuff that was supposed to be in that particular room in the temple had presumably been slung out somewhere else. We don't know where it had been put, but clearly Tobiah's claim over the temple was considered higher than all those things. A wealthy pagan, then, setting up office in the temple precincts with the priest's permission. Abuse of temple property, whatever there was. In addition to that, there's a second symptom, neglect of God's ministers. Look at verses 10 and 11. I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and singers responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. In other words, the tithes weren't being collected. The things the people were supposed to be providing to meet the needs of the people who served God in the temple staff, were simply not there. And the Levites hadn't got a bean to their name, hadn't got two pennies to rub together. They had to go back to their fields and start growing grain in order to keep body and soul together. They couldn't spend any time in the temple looking after it. They hadn't got the financial resources to do so. So God's ministers were being neglected too. On top of that, if you look at verses 13 to 18, 15 to 18 rather, you'll see there was a neglect of God's day. In those days I saw men in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in grain and loading it on donkeys together with wine and grapes, figs and all other kinds of loads. It wasn't just residents either who were conducting their business on the Sabbath. We read in verse 16 that merchants from the coast, from Tyre, were being allowed into the city to trade on the same day. A neglect then of God's day, something which was terribly important, of course, to Jews at this time, because it marked them out culturally from their foreign neighbours. And on top of all that, there was a neglect of God's standards. I think that's the best way to express what was going on in verse 23 and following. Moreover, in those days I saw men of Judah who had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. Half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod or the language of one of the other peoples and did not know how to speak the language of Judah. Mixed marriages then between Jews and pagans. And these things were destroying the cultural identity of the Jewish people. Within a generation, Nehemiah could see the day when the Hebrew language would be lost altogether. They wouldn't be able to speak it. All these things then, put them together, and what have you got? You've got spiritual neglect. You've got what we might call in the New Testament vocabulary, worldliness. You've got people who are not interested in their distinctives as the people of God, but are just interested in making money, getting married to whoever they please. Forget about the temple. Forget about the clergy. Forget about anything that relates to the religious distinctives of the people of God. Spiritual neglect. Now it's important to realize that these people were not idolaters. In former generations, the prophets had inveighed against Jews for worshipping foreign gods and that kind of thing. And rightly so. But these people that Nehemiah is concerned with were not faithless apostates. These were people who had voluntarily come back from Babylon in order to build a temple, to build a wall, to re-establish a Jewish state. These weren't idolaters. If anything, these were the incipient Pharisees. These were the seedbed of the Judaism, which we find in Jesus' day, a few hundred years later. And yet, spiritual neglect among them, worldliness among them. A great lesson in that. For you see, worldliness is always a second-generation temptation for the people of God. In the infancy of any new movement of God's Spirit, the zeal is there. But as the years pass by, and the work becomes consolidated, the statements of faith are formulated, doctrinal orthodoxy is secured, then comes the second generation temptation, the pressure to compromise, to lower standards. The arguments are often very plausible, words like toleration and progress and unity and so on are banded around. But the effect is always the same, that the pristine zeal of people is sapped and replaced by a cozier, less embarrassing, less demanding spirit. The spirit of the world. And that's precisely what was happening to these Jews. Time was passing by, and the enthusiasm was waning. The wall had been built, they were secure. Now it was time to make money, Nehemiah, not build walls any longer. Those were the good old days. But now we had to be practical. And I have to say that that seems to me to be a situation which is very relevant to the church in the 20th century. We've had our wars to fight, we've had our battles to win, battles against heresy, battles against paganism in earlier generations. But it strikes me that as we look around the church today, even the evangelical church, where Christian orthodoxy is impeccable and unquestionable, if we look carefully, we find the very same kinds of attitudes that Nehemiah observed. An attitude to worship, for instance, which is casual. Casual about attending church, about personal habits of Bible reading or prayer. Casual about the Lord's Day. Oh no, I'm not a Sabbatarian myself. And I wouldn't want to pull these verses in Nehemiah straight out and apply them to Debenham's stores, though the temptation is there, isn't it? There are some Christians, of course, who would believe that Sunday is a Christian Sabbath and would want to oppose the opening of shops on Sunday for that reason, for the same reason Nehemiah did, because there is a moral law against it. I don't think, actually, that that could be proven from the New Testament. At least you'd have a hard job proving it. But it is certainly true that the people of God ought to respect the Lord's Day, and there ought to be more in their lives than simply making money. And if we can't give a day up of the week to worship God and think about God, to serve the needs of our families and to seek to teach our children spiritual lessons, if we can't give up a seventh of our time in order to do that, then there is something very sadly spiritually astray in our priorities, Sabbath or no Sabbath. Neglect of God's ministers, too. No, I'm not speaking personally here. But I wonder if you're aware of the average salary of a pastor. I'm not speaking personally, but you would be embarrassed if you knew it. You'd be even more embarrassed if you received it. For the tithes and the offerings, I'm afraid, don't come in as they ought to. A church with 10 wage earners ought to be able to support a pastor to the same level as the average of the congregation. There are plenty of churches with 50 members that don't do that. And neglect of God's standards when it comes to family life, too. Mixed marriages. Well, the arguments are very common, aren't they? My wife's got every right to worship whichever God she pleases. Person's religion's their own business, that's what I say. Doesn't do to be closed-minded. We'll all get there in the end. The Reverend so-and-so said it only last Sunday. I reckon Nehemiah were bigoted myself, making all that fuss about mixed marriages. So plausible, isn't it? And yet clearly, you see, God thinks differently. I don't wish to judge anybody, I really don't. But we must face up to what God says here in His Word about the dangers of a neglect of God's standards in this matter. So plausible in our tolerant days to think that we can be pluralistic, when in fact what pluralism does to the people of God is to destroy them, destroy their distinctiveness. We have no more Christian families, just Christian individuals. Suffer. That's where it finishes up. And all put together, you see, it just shows spiritual neglect. It shows half-heartedness. It shows we are slack and indifferent about spiritual things. And all put together, you see, it just shows spiritual neglect. It shows half-heartedness. It shows we are slack and indifferent about spiritual things. The characteristic of our age. Let's notice how Nehemiah coped with it, how he responded to it. The first way he responded, rebuke. That word comes up again and again and again in each of these situations. First of all, in verse 11 of chapter 13, regarding the abuse of temple property. I rebuked the officials and asked them, why is the house of God neglected? Then again in verse 17, with regard to the keeping of God's day. I rebuked the nobles of Judah and said to them, what is this wicked thing you are doing, desecrating the Sabbath day? And again in verse 25, regarding the mixed marriages. I rebuked them and called curses down on them and beat some of the men and pulled out their hair. I made them take an oath in God's name and said, you are not to give your daughters in marriage to their sons, nor are you to take their daughters in marriage for your sons or for yourselves. Was it not, he says, because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Reminds them, you see, of the lessons of history. Rebuking them. There's a strong lesson for us here. We need to be willing, when there is a spiritual neglect evident among the people of God, to rebuke one another. It's the only way we're going to stir one another up out of our indifference and our apathy. We need to be willing to rebuke the clergy, as Nehemiah did, rebuking them for their neglect of God's house. We need to be willing to rebuke the government, as Nehemiah did, about the use of the Lord's Day. We need to be willing to rebuke one another regarding this issue of family life and choosing our partners and that kind of thing. It's not a case of petty-mindedness. It's a case of being concerned that the people of God should be the kind of people God intended them to be. Nehemiah wasn't afraid to rebuke. But what I want you to notice, too, is that he was very careful to instruct. And that takes us back to chapter 8 of his book, his memoirs. The public teaching of God's law. Now, again, to be honest, where this actually comes in Nehemiah's life is very difficult to determine. It's all mixed up with a complicated controversy about the date of Ezra's arrival in Jerusalem. The Bible seems to suggest in the book of Ezra that Ezra had been in Jerusalem for some 13 years before Nehemiah arrived. But there are some problems associated with that, and there are some scholars who believe that the actual figure in Ezra chapter 7 verse 8, which says when Ezra arrived in Jerusalem, is a copyist error or something like that, and that he actually arrived much later. Some scholars have speculated that Ezra actually arrived in Jerusalem when Nehemiah returned for his second term, and that Nehemiah brought him with him to Jerusalem precisely so he could teach the law, because Nehemiah was so aware of the problems that were arising among the people and realized the law had to be taught as a long-term solution. So where it is that chapters 8, 9, and 10 and following actually come in Nehemiah's life is difficult to determine. But one thing is quite clear. Nehemiah believed that what you have to do if you are going to build the people of God soundly is not just rebuke them when they go wrong, but instruct them in the word of God before they go wrong. You see in chapter 8 here then, we read how Ezra the scribe was told to bring out the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded for Israel. And on the first day of the seventh month, Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, which was made up of men and women, and all who were able to understand. He read it aloud from daybreak till noon, as he faced the square before the water gate, in the presence of the men, women, and others who could understand. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law. Several interesting things to pick out from these chapters, though we can't look into them in detail. One is the concern that Nehemiah, who was behind this move, clearly had to see that the word of God should be understood clearly. Because we read in verse 4 that Ezra was made to stand on a high wooden platform built for the occasion. A pulpit, in other words. No ritual mumbling. This message was to be heard. Notice too the reverence with which the word was heard. Verse 6. When Ezra praised the Lord, the great God, all the people lifted their hands and responded. They bowed down and worshipped the Lord with their faces to the ground. All the people stood up, we read in verse 5, when he opened the book to read it. Great reverence then. This was a message to be respected, not just heard. But most interesting of all, notice verses 7 to 8. The care which is laid down that the people should not just hear and respect what they were listening to, but actually understand it. For we read, the Levites, they're named, instructed the people in the law while the people were standing there. They read from the book of the law, making it clear and giving the meaning so the people could understand what was being read. In some cases, this may well have meant actual translation, into Aramaic, because that was the only language the people knew. But almost certainly it also involved exposition, explaining what the law demanded. Great concern then to see that the word of God should be publicly heard, respected, and understood. Yes, and notice something else too. Nehemiah is quite clearly concerned not only that the word should be heard and respected and understood, but that it should be responded to by the reformation of society. And that's really what verses 38 of chapter 9 through to the end of chapter 10 are about. We find here a solemn covenant which the people make. The nobility and all the rest of the people together, we're told. And from verse 30 onwards of chapter 10, you'll see the specifics which are laid down that they undertake to obey, having heard the law of God through Moses, the servant of God. We promise, they say, not to give our daughters in marriage to the peoples around us, or take their daughters for our sons. When neighboring peoples bring merchandise or grain to sell on the Sabbath, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or any holy day. Every seventh year we will forego working the land and will cancel all debts. We assume the responsibility for carrying out the commands to give a third of the shekel each year for the service of the house of our God. We, the priests, the Levites, and the people, have cast lots to determine when each of our families is to bring to the house of our God at set times each year a contribution of wood to burn on the altar. We also assume responsibility for bringing to the house of the Lord each year the first fruits. Moreover, we will bring to the storerooms of the house of our God, verse 37, to the priests, the first of our ground meal, our grain offerings, and the fruit of all our trees, and so on. And at the end, we will not neglect the house of our God. We see how many of those things echo the problems of chapter 13. It seems to be a specific covenant undertaken to solve that problem, but this time not in response merely to a negative rebuke on Nehemiah's part, but in response to the positive teaching, the public preaching of God's word. Well, here we have it then. Leadership. Nehemiah, a model leader. A man of prayer, who was willing to petition God for the impossible. A man of courage, who stuck to his guns even when circumstances were difficult. Today, a man of principle, who stood up for what was right. Leaders are in short supply in our society generally, and in the church specifically. Perhaps it's worth noticing that Nehemiah's greatest triumph, the pinnacle of his ministry here in chapter 10, was not accomplished through the sword, but through personal example, through public preaching. Notice, will you, at the very beginning of chapter 10, whose name heads all the others as signatories of this solemn covenant the people made. Nehemiah the governor, the son of Hakaliah. When we have men of his stamp, once again, in our country and in our church, then we may hope once again to see greatness return to our country and to the church in our land. Let's pray together.